Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Paul is in Seattle and builds and designs and refinishes furniture. He's worked extensively with hand tools and is familiar with them. Paul, could you give us some idea of what tools you use in your woodworking?
All kinds. I use a number of different hand planes, spoke shavers, files, chisels I've bought, chisels I've made, carving tools, tools for turning on the lathe, draw knives, brazen bits, scrapers.
Wow. For the ignorant, what's a plane? Doesn't that smooth down the surface?
There's hand planes, different types of hand planes. Different cultures would have them made slightly differently. The Germans would have wooden bodies made out of beech wood with like a lignum vitam wood on the bottom, which was much harder wood, so it would hold up better. And then you have the metal knife inside, which they all do. The British tend to have more of the metal base bodies of the planes or shoes or what they called. They're heavier, they're more fatiguing, but they would cut in more. These are for planing, flattening and squaring up and truing up the wood surface. And then they have different sizes and for different purposes, like ones would have, there were some that were called scrub planes that were for roughing it out very quickly so that they would have kind of a scallop type of edge to the knife. And you can oftentimes on very old pieces of furniture feel along the bottom of the, say, the chair bottom or the tabletop, the bottom of the tabletop, and feel like ridges or scallops in them. And that's caused by the old hand scrub planes. It's just for rapid removal of the wood.
I remember my dad using one of those. He used to design and build furniture in his basement. And as a little girl, I was fortunate enough to go down and hang around in the workshop and help him out, hand him his tools or whatever, and watch what he was doing. And also my grandfather still has some of these tools down in the basement of the house I inherited. It's kind of like a scraper on a road. The scraping part is at an angle. And the plane itself is, like you said, Paul, either a block of wood or a block of metal, and this angled scraping blade is sticking out of the bottom, not 100% crosswise, but at a slight angle so that it bites in. And what happens as you move it along a piece of wood is any piece that lumps up, like let's say lumpy gravel at the side of the road when there's a smoothing scraper coming down the road, it bites into that and peels it off at the direction of angle to the side, kind of peels it off to the side.
Right.
So that when you're first planing, you get kind of a resistance and you can feel that you're bump, bump, you're hitting into things and peeling it off. As it gets smooth, there is no resistance and the plane just kind of flies down, right?
Right. And, you know, it's actually surprisingly a precision piece of equipment, as seemingly rudimentary as it is. You need to work with it and practice with it to get it so it's adjusted. It really does the job well, because when it's set perfectly, it just shaves just a super thin piece of wood off, and it's really enjoyable to work with when you have a nice sharp knife and it's set properly. And of course, there's different, an amazing array of different planes, way they're used and purposes that they're used, because some you can adjust the throat opening for so it will cut out bigger chunks of wood, and then adjust it so you make the opening smaller so the piece of wood that it's slicing out is thinner and thinner. There's finished planes for the real finished type of smooth surface, and then there's pattern maker planes and leveling planes that are real long because they'll make, you know, your surface perfectly straight and flat. There's planes that are on a skew. A regular plane knife is cut at a 90 degrees. And I'm not talking about the bevel that makes it sharp. I'm talking about the knife itself, square, 90 degrees. The skew ones are cut at an angle say 45 degrees, probably closer to a 30 degree angle, and then the edge is put on that 30 degree angle. So when you're running it along the wood, and generally they're used for like end grain of the wood, when you're running it along, it has more of a slicing motion. Because if it's just the flat piece, the flat blade, and you're running it along the end of the board, the end grain, it tends to want to compress the pores of the wood rather than slice them when it's the straight blade. So if it's on a skew, like, oh, perfect example would be like the guillotine, the blades of the guillotine, you know, the knife of the guillotine?
Oh, yeah.
How that's at an angle, that's the skew of these types of planes. And they tend to slice then when you're pushing them along, slice the grain. And so those are used more for end grain wood. Same with low profile planes. And what that means is that the blade of the plane is set at a lower angle to the wood. So most planes are, let's say, at a 30 degree angle to the wood, but the low profile are set at a lower angle so that they tend to slice more.
I remember the manual planes had a screw where you could loosen it and you could move the blade up or down. If you wanted to bite out more of the wood,
right,
you move the blade down.
Right.
And if you wanted to just barely be under the surface of the flat wood or metal that you were rolling across the board, you would have it almost so that you could barely, you'd run your finger down the bottom, you could barely feel,
right,
catch your finger at all on that blade. It was so, just a little bit.
It's really high tolerance. As much, you're just barely moving it, it can make a huge amount of difference. I have some older planes that didn't have that fine adjustment screw and spring system, and you would have to move it. It basically had a wooden wedge in there to hold the knife in place. You would just have to kind of wiggle the blade and tap it just lightly with a real small hammer to get it where you want it. And so it was just kind of a fussy little thing that you would pony up to where you needed it to be and then knock your wedge in tight to hold it in place. And, yeah, of course, they improved on the design and stuff, but that was far more rudimentary method how it was for centuries.
Ah, yes. And as I recall, the level was very important because when you're smoothing a board, you'd put the level down to make sure that what you were planing, that you weren't, making hills and valleys as you merrily planed
away.
Yeah,
well, a straight edge.
Yeah, straight edge, right.
Level or straight edge, either one.
Right.
If you're planing it to make it nice and straight and flat, that's why the much longer pattern makers type of planes are what you would use. You know, the longer the shoe, like a Cadillac driving on the road is going to feel less bumps than a real small car because it's just going to run over, level things out better.
Right. In other words, that big board or that big piece of metal that floats along, the bigger it is, the more you're assured that you're not making hills and valleys.
Correct.
Right. Differ from a chisel. In other words, a chisel, like a knife, how do you make sure that your chisel is where you want it to be? So in other words, if you're chiseling out a groove on the wood, do you make a mark with a pencil or something to make sure that you're staying within the bounds that you want to? And how do you make sure that the depth of what you're chiseling out is an even depth?
Well, there's different methods, and it depends on what you're trying to achieve. And there's some things, if you can saw into it first, if it's a situation where you can use a saw, you'll cut a bunch of different curves with the handsaw to a specific depth. Like you'll take your marker or your square, your ruler, whatever you're going to use to mark your depth with, and you'll, say, mark it on the edge of your wood, the depth that you want. And then you'll saw your curves, a series of curves side by side to that depth. Then you come in with your chisel with the flat side along the surface that you want leveled out at the bottom of your saw curves, and take your mallet and just tap along it, and those uh, the remaining wood just chips out easily, particularly, obviously, if your chisel's real sharp. So if you cut down with the saw to the specific level that you've marked, and you have a series of these curves down to that same level, that pretty much determines how deep you're going to go and makes it very easy to have a nice flat surface when you finish up, because that works like a stop in a sense and gives you a location where you're going to stop.
Right. When you're talking about marking, is that called scoring? For instance, if I put a straight edge like a ruler down and I take a razor and I run it along the edge of that ruler, I'm scoring it. But what you're talking about is doing that in a more precision way where you know for sure the depth of that scoring.
Right. That's why, you know, it depends on what you're doing. If you're, say, hand carving something pretty or whatever, you're doing more artwork, and that's more by eye and freehanding in a sense with tools. If you're doing something more functional, say carving out a notch to put a hinge in, a door hinge in, then you're going to be doing it in a series of different ways. For instance, you would draw out your area that the hinge is going to go into on the piece of wood, both the depth and the location that the hinge goes, the size of it. Then you're going to take your brace and bit, which is, you know, your hand drill and your drill bit, and you're going to drill down to the depth you want to go. And one way you can do that is, if you have, say, masking tape, that you can tape it onto the drill to the level that you want it, you know, just above the level you want it, and then just drill down to the tape. If you don't have that, you can mark it some way. If not, you're just going to have to, you know, guess at it. But experience, you know, it's not that difficult to do after you've done it a little bit. So you take out the bulk of the wood that you have to remove with the drill, and then you come back with the chisel and the mallet and clean out the rest. And what you would be to take the flat edge of the chisel along the cross grain, the line that you have marked on your cross grain first, and hammer down to cut across the grain, to cut the wood fibers across the grain first, both top and bottom of your markings. And then you come and tap lightly along the line that goes with the grain. But that you have to be careful, because if you do it too hard and too try and take too much at once, you can split your wood very easily. So that one you do kind of more finesse. Then you come back and you turn your chisel over so that the beveled side is down, and you start tapping the back of the chisel with your mallet and cleaning out the remaining wood. And where you have gone cross grain, cut across the grain, that'll work like a stop. So as you come up to it and you hit that, it'll just stop it. But see, that's what you want to do first, is go across the grain, cutting the fibers across the grain, because if you don't, it'll just continue cutting.
I gotcha. Now, with chisels, it sticks in my mind that there are some chisels that have like a curve, like you would cut out. If you went whacking down the surface of a board, with that chisel, you would have a nice little groove cut out round that water would roll down. But
Like gouges, you mean?
It's like a chisel that has got it's like a half circle.
Yeah.
The sharp end is like a half circle, so that if you tapped it down the board, you would end up having a nice little half circle,
yeah.
Kind of like a trench in the
right,
wood
gouge.
That water would run out of if you wanted to, I mean, so to speak, you know. But there's other chisels. There's other chisels that are just straight across, right? And they're meant to, as you said, create a opening in a door jamb for where the lock might go. And
right.
You want a straight edge, right? Different kinds. What about saws? There are some saws that bite and are meant for rapid cutting of wood, and other saws that are really kind of fine. That's like the teeth that are turned to the right, the left, in other words, and do the biting. They may be gross and large, or they may be very fine, so that when you saw, you're really taking away part of the wood, but if it's a fine saw, you're taking away a 16th of an inch, maybe. And if it's a gross saw, you might be taking away, wow, almost half an inch, right?
Well, not half an inch, but 16th of an inch on the fine, yes. Yeah, what they have is, if you can picture, I'm sure most people have used like a pruning saw or something for trees, you know, for your lawn and garden. Those are very coarse, extremely coarse, very few saw teeth per inch. The set, that's how much the teeth are bent outward side to side from the straight line of the saw. The teeth are set out right and left, and they're set out pretty far on the course, and that's for very rapid removal of wood, and so it expels the wood that you've removed. It takes it out quickly and gets rid of it out of the way. And then the finer teeth, there's a lot more teeth per inch, and there's the set is not nearly as intense as the coarser ones, and that's obviously for finer work, because you can't use it for, number one, because it's slower, but the teeth will clog up with the sawdust and stuff if you were trying doing it with things where it's coarse. So yes, there's different ones. There's just the regular hand saws, and they're kind of like a medium and coarse or construction type of work, but then there's things like dovetail saws and back saws that are more for finish type of work. And they are finer. And there's hand tools for putting in the set in the teeth, and of course files for resharpening the teeth. And it's that in itself is a very time consuming and something that you have to work on to get to where you're good at it, because you can really mess up your saws if you're not good at it.
I have a crosscut saw in my basement from my grandfather's days, and it's meant to be run by two people on either side of a let's say, a downed tree where
yes.
They want to cut it up into sections. And the teeth on that are amazingly huge and coarse. They're like a inch across, and they twist
yeah.
to the side. If I look down on it, it seems like it's almost half an inch or more from side to side where the teeth would bite. But that's meant to clean out, as you say, the sawdust.
Right.
And so you can
chips.
Keep going. I remember trying to saw a board, and the most frustrating thing is, as you're coming down through the board, you have it braced on the right, braced on the left, and maybe you've got your knee up somewhere to keep the board from jumping around, working away, holding it with my left hand, sawing with my right, and pretty soon the top of the saw is being pinched by the board on either side, and I can't move that saw. In other words, the board kind of collapses on the top, and the two sides that are now separated come together and want to touch, and the saw doesn't have any more maneuverability. When you saw, what's the proper technique for sawing a board? Maybe I was just going about it all wrong.
It depends, of course, on the size of the board. If it's a large board, you're going to want to support it with a couple fixtures, sawhorses, something of that nature, on both sides of the cut. I'm thinking specifically right now, like, say, a 4x8 sheet of plywood, something large of that nature. You're going to want, say, a couple of sawhorses on each side, so that as you are cutting through the board, it's not bending downward and putting pressure on the saw and pinching it. If it's a board, now there's sometimes you're going to get boards that aren't dried or seasoned right, and plenty of times in the future maybe you'll be working with green wood. That's not going to be too much of a problem, but lots of woods will have tension in them already from the way that the tree grew or dried, and so that as you're cutting through it, if it's dried unevenly or if there's tension in it already from growing bent, as it cuts, the wood's going to start pinching, and that's a problem. You're going to need help holding it apart, or you're going to have to, once you start getting the saw into it further, have wooden wedges, and then you can pound the wedge into the back end of the kerf that you've cut out to open up the cut more, and just keep pounding it in further as you saw further into it.
Why didn't I think of that? A wedge. Good idea. In making furniture, at times you're going to want to create a circular cut. I know that there's hacksaws that have a tiny blade that's maybe only a quarter of an inch wide. They only go so far because the frame of the saw is holding that narrow blade maybe 6 inches away from an edge, so you can't go that far. Now, we're talking about non-electric. We're not talking about these kind of saws where they have
right.
a little blade going up and down. All you have to do is drill a hole and get the blade in there, and you
right.
can go make any kind of a design that you've drawn on the board and cut it out finely. With manual saws, that's not quite possible, or it's difficult. You have to have enough support in your saw blade to keep it from bending and going whang, whang, and bending to the side. So how do you go about that manually? I suppose there's tools.
There's saws called fret saws, and you can get different sized ones with different depth of throats. They basically use blades like the ones that are in modernized or motorized jigsaws, and they're just the hand ones, or the old style. Blades come off, similar to a hacksaw, but they're much smaller, much thinner. And you just put that through your hole that you've drilled. Same type of idea. The big thing is, if you're going to be doing fine work, building yourself furniture, you're going to want to either acquire or build yourself a vise. You're going to need one, two types of holding devices and a workbench and things like that that the vise are mounted on, because you're going to have to be able to hold your work. So the fret saw, that you just take the blade off, put it through the hole, hook it back up, and then the neck of the fret saw is, it's like a big bow. And you, like I said, you can get different ones that are much deeper, real deep. In fact, you can cut out your circle. Your circle you can make with, if you don't have a compass, anything that's like a string, shoelace, whatever. Something you can attach it to the center and use it as a radius. Use something to mark, a nail, pencil, a pin, whatever, you know, to scribe into the wood. You have the string anchored to the center of your circle, and on the other end of the string you have what's going to scribe into the wood, and you just pull it around the circle. You have yourself a circle.
Yeah, cool. When you design furniture, as I know that you have, what would be the prevailing principle, for instance, for a table? I used to have an old-fashioned table that was made out of oak. It was an original antique of some sort. And a lot of antiques are like that, where they have a single pedestal in the middle of the table, and then this pedestal has feet that go out and around to stabilize it, rather than four legs at either corner of the table. Is there a practical reason for that?
The pedestal was designed as far as something different, something artistic, that type of thing. The arts came into it, and all of the pedestals and all things like that came about. I think the simplest, you know, when you're just talking functionality and practicality, you're going to go four legs and something as functional as possible and as quickly as possible. Each person, depending upon the materials they have to work with, is going to have to look at it and make the decision what's best with what they have to work with. Probably the easiest one would be the four legs. It's certainly going to be the most stable.
So how do you affix that leg to the table? Is it like brace on either side? Is it kind of like a little triangle snugged up against each leg on either side to hold it and glued?
There's just a whole bunch of different ways of doing it, and the best thing that people can do is try and accumulate as much information as they can right now off the internet, from even how to render the high glue, which incidentally is what I still use, because it's still the best glue for furniture. It was being made by the Egyptians. Learn how to render the high glue from hides.
What's the recipe?
I have it printed down in my supplies. I can't tell you what the recipe is right now, but
what kind of sticks in your mind as the basic recipe?
Well, it's
you're saying
basic.
Rendering. That means cooking it down.
Cooking
right?
it down. Yeah, it's the what is it? The caissons in the animal hide, and various hides have various qualities that are cattle, deer, buffalo, things like that. That the larger animal hides.
You use
are
the
best,
hides, not
bear.
The hooves.
They
yeah.
use hooves, but they're lesser quality. The hide's the best.
Really? And
yep.
so you're cooking, and this is like not a hide that has been cured or tanned, but a raw hide, right? Raw hide, and you toss it in the pot, and you cook it, and then you cook it down.
I think it's part of the process of all of it. I would have to, I got this information off the internet year and a half ago, so I would have to go back and read it, so I can't tell you for sure on that. I do remember they said, like, they'll use rabbits, but rabbits, it's not very strong. That's more of, they use that glue for more crafts work, for more structural type of work, for furniture and stuff. It's the larger animals. I think bear
really?
Is the strongest.
Yeah, so interesting, and that's about it. There's no special additive. If we're caught out in the woods somewhere, we can make glue.
Don't know any special additives. So the biggest thing is that before they were using glues, it's the types of wood joints you use and how tight you made just the quality of your work. Before they came up with the dovetail joint, which is, how to describe it, it's basically a triangle. One piece of wood is, the end of a piece of wood is cut like the tail of a dove, like a triangle. And then the other piece of wood is cut to receive that. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle.
Right.
One fits in the other hand in glove.
Tongue
so
and
that,
groove, right.
With that, it creates a wedging type of situation so that it can't pull apart easily. It can
right.
only pull
and,
apart
and you,
one direction.
Right. You put it together sideways
yeah.
because the tension or stretch is forward and backwards so that when you put it together sideways, you can slide this in.
One thing people can do is just take a look at their furniture and
right.
pull a drawer open.
Right.
Not all furniture has dovetailed assembled drawers, but lots do, and they can look on the ends of their drawers,
right.
furniture drawers, and they'll see that.
Right.
And so that was one way of, one very, very popular and very successful way of connecting pieces of wood together. Tongue and groove, and a mortise and tenon.
What's a mortise and tenon?
Mortise and tenon were, if you can picture, say, you have a board, and you have the end of the board, and then you cut shoulders on the board so that the very end of it you have a smaller section sticking out that's like a tongue, I guess you'd call it. That's the tenon. The board proportionally smaller all the way around by, say, eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch. So it's on the top surface of the board, it's, say, an eighth of an inch narrower, and on the bottom surface is an eighth of an inch narrower, on the sides an eighth of an inch narrower, so that its overall dimension is maybe a quarter of an inch smaller all the way around than the dimension of the board itself, as far as the height and width goes, and then the length of it is maybe half an inch sticking out, and that then would go into another board mortise slot that's cut in the other board to receive this tenon.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They go together.
Yeah.
But that's intended to be used with the glue.
Yeah.
And, you know, the glue initially was just designed to swell the pores of the wood so that when it went in there, the wood would swell, and then the glue would dry and keep it all swelled up. So it really wasn't designed like, say, epoxy, where it became a structural thing.
But does it still work? I mean,
it works tremendously. Like I said, high glue still, I think, is the best.
Very strong.
It has very unique properties.
Right.
The man still has not been able to duplicate with their synthetic.
I'll be darned. Well, now, on something like a chair, oftentimes the legs of the chair are inserted into the seat with a hole. I mean, the seat has a hole bored into it
right.
with some kind of a drill. and the leg will stick in there and glued. And then, of course, the legs are cured with each other, maybe some sort of a network of wires or other little pieces of wood going crisscross, or, you know, so that the legs don't splay out or bend, or they don't, you know, they can handle the pressure that they might be put on as people drop into them and jump up and lean sideways and the like, right?
You're going to have to think in terms of, okay, if you don't have glue, how do you make it hold together? If you don't have nails, and kind of the way that our ancestors long, long ago had to do, the way they came up was really rather simple common sense, but very practical and good, was that they would drill through with using their brazen bits and drill all the way through the wood that was to receive the stretcher bars. Stretcher bars are the pieces of wood that go between the leg. So they would drill through, they'd make their legs stocky enough that they could hold up to being drilled through and still be strong enough. They'd drill through the leg, run the board through the leg, and they had cut a slot in the end grain of the board, the stretcher bar coming through. So, in other words, if you can picture having a piece of wood and hold it up, say a board that's maybe 12 inches long by 1 inch thick by 1 inch thick. You're holding it up vertically so that it's running 12 inches up, and you take a saw and you cut down 1 inch from the end grain, down 1 inch running lengthwise. So you cut a slot into that. Cut it like a very thin wedge shape, perhaps an eighth of an inch at the top of it to nothing at the bottom of it, 1 inch down or half an inch down or so. You put that in through the hole, and then you have another wedge that fits into that slot. And then you pound that wedge in, and it splays the wood wider, and it that holds it then. The one thing you want to make sure you do, though, put the stretcher bar in the hole so that when the wood splays wider, that it's opening up along with the grain and not across the grain. Because if you do it across the grain, you'll split your wood. Yeah, you picture what I'm saying?
So this is in addition to the glue. This is a technique?
No, this is without glue. This is before they had glue.
Ah.
If you don't have glue, this is how you do it.
Right. You're creating a tension, a permanent tension.
Yes.
Where some of the wood wants to expand, and the other wood is squeezing it.
Right. The stretcher bar wood, you are expanding it by pounding the wedge in it.
Ah.
So the deeper you pound the wedge in, the wider it spreads it. And so it's spreading it against the walls of the hole that you've put it into.
Ah. Now, in finishing furniture, I recently got an antique spinning wheel that really was very scuffy looking and dull. And it popped in my head that I should use linseed oil, which I got, which is nothing other than flax oil. Flax is something that can be grown. Actually, you make linen out of the flax fibers. And flax and oil is something that people can eat and as an additive. I've heard even keeps you from getting your skin from breaking in the dry winter time. People add flax oil to their cereal or whatever, and they have less dry skin and cracking fingernails. But as far as furniture refinishing, this was just flat-out linseed oil from flax oil, and I applied it to the spinning wheel, and it just shines and glows like I put several coats of varnish on it. I was stunned.
Yeah, but it has to be boiled first. Because if you just go straight linseed oil that's not boiled, it'll never dry. So it has to be boiled linseed oil. And boiled linseed oil has, for centuries, been, you know, one of the key ingredients of finishes and paints and things. So, yeah, that works. It's, you know, modern finishes have much greater protection qualities now than the boiled linseed oil. That's great shellac, but it's not something that's, I doubt very much it's going to be readily available since it's from, I believe it's from bugs from the Orient.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to have polyurethane or plastic varnish.
No.
We're probably not going to have a varnish. I'm not sure what goes into that, which are harder substances, you know, that are more durable for stains. Really, something with linseed oil, that's bare wood. It's kind of oiled bare wood.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can wax it, and then it'll buff up.
Right, and wax was really a big thing, you know, for centuries, for the finish.
What about staining? Some people would stain, and I'm not sure what stains are exactly, but are they just from, like, boiled nut shells or something?
Oh, gosh, they're from everything. You know, it all kind of roots back to the days of making your own oil colors, oil paints, you know, the artist. There's books that tell, and, like, some people would put nails in water and make them rust and then get the oxide.
Oh, my word.
To use for some stain.
Right.
And you'd mix it into boiled linseed oil and use that. There's other blackberries, blueberries. It's just kind of like use your mind. Pay attention to what's out there and experiment.
Right, right.
Currently, there's like finishes. There's opaque colors, oil colors, universal colorants, and they, you know, all of that comes from raw earth. Not all of it, but much of it comes from raw earth materials. And then whether it's grinding of gems or things lamp black or cobalt blue, things like that. And then there's aniline dyes. And the dyes, again, are raw earth properties. And I think if you get some art books.
Yeah, I know that a lot of plants are have natural dyes.
Yes.
Amaranth, there's a red burgundy amaranth that I think is also used for dyeing. These secrets are like not readily available to modern man who just takes it for granted.
Yeah.
Doesn't get a dye.
One thing that you have to do, though, is when you go with the colors, you need to mix them with something like vinegar so that the color will hold.
Ah.
Because otherwise it'll separate out.
Ah. And then you just mix it. Rather than apply it directly to the wood, you mix it maybe with a linseed oil.
Yes. You can also apply it to, like, if it's mixed up with, say, a little bit of vinegar and water, you can apply it like it's a dye, and it'll penetrate deeper into the wood. It's a thing where you're going to experiment if you have the time to do that and kind of learn, because when you do that, the wood, various woods are different, too. Oak tends to take stains and finishes very easily, very evenly. Walnut does pretty well, but woods like cherry, alder, maple, they tend to get very blotchy when you use a dye on them because they'll soak up real deep in certain areas and then not very deep in other areas, and they get very blotchy looking. Birch gets blotchy. And so then if you use like a linseed oil mixed into it, it won't soak into the grain as deeply and as quickly, so you get a more even tone to it. So it would be more like an experimentation depending upon what wood they're using and what the stain is they're using, all that type of stuff. A lot of variables.
Speaking of different types of woods, when you're making furniture, for instance, are there some woods that are choice for like a tabletop, some woods that would be really strong and not break for maybe a leg and the like?
Yeah, you know, actually, our forefathers, you know, I would really recommend people go out and go to the library or whatever, see if they can find books by, I believe his name was Eric, and he would write books on Americana. He'd do pen and ink drawings on them. Just a wealth of information about our forefathers, just their common horse sense and reasons they had for doing so many of the things they did, you know, why they would point their barns in certain directions. That would give you so much information, the stuff that much of society no longer knows and should know again. And that speaks about the types of woods that are used for certain properties. For instance, hickory, ash, they're both very flexible woods, so they were used a lot for steaming and bending. For instance, hickory and ash in particular, was used a lot for skis because it's very flexible before it'll break. Our forefathers often would use different woods for different functions on one chair. For instance, they would use pine for the seat because it was softer. They would use, say, maple for the legs, hickory for the stretcher bars and for the spindles that run up the back because they would flex more but not break. They would use ash for if they did a bow back chair where they would steam it and bend it to be a bow. So, yes, the, a lot of different properties.
Wow. Also caned chairs, which is a type of seating or backing, usually the seating that would allow breathing, and so you wouldn't be sitting in a pool of sweat on a hot summer day. And he did this by putting holes around the edge in a, with a drill. The cane would go through and come back across and through and back across, and then it was a pattern of in and out that he was weaving, and it would be, then you'd have diagonal. It would be crosswise and then diagonal in,
right.
in both directions, and it made for a very very strong seat. And by the fact that it's called caning, I would gather that it means stripping this from some sort of a cane, like a reed.
Yep.
Like or
I believe from rattan.
From rattan, right.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, and it's like the bark part of that
right.
reed that you'd strip. It wasn't very thick. Was about an eighth of an inch to a quarter of an inch wide, and but very, very strong. And I don't think they did, they really didn't even finish it in any particular way. Just there it was.
Well, they didn't. It, because it had the bark, the natural coating of the rattan on the outside of it, it didn't need to be. The underside had the interior, which was more of a pulpy type of, so it would accept a stain. But we still do it. We do the hand caning and the pre-woven sheet cane, and lots of times it's finished to match up the chair that it's on. And so we have to either use a dye on it or a combination of a dye and glaze and then put a finish on. But other times it's just left natural. It just depends on the situation. But it can definitely be left natural and it, without any detrimental effects to it. The one thing would be that if you can add some oil to the underside of it, help keep it more pliable. But, that would be something, again, that you can go to the library on and look up and learn how. It's nothing that takes any great skill. It's very time-consuming. It takes, a good caner, which there's not a whole lot of people that do it anymore, can do an average chair in about 10 hours, I'd say, 10 to 12 hours. But it's just a repetitive thing, and you're weaving, hand weaving these strands of cane in and out. You're soaking them in warm water for approximately 20 minutes, the strands of cane. If you have wooden dowels, say 5/16 to 3/8 inch dowels, that you turn into wedges, like sharpened pencils, only it's a much longer wedge. Or like golfing tees. And you use them to poke into the hole to hold the strands of cane in there while you're working. Then you just weave it on in. You're right. You have, first you go vertical and you want to go square. Then you go horizontal. Then you go vertical again. And then you go vertical again on top. Then you go horizontal again. When you go horizontal again, you start your weaving. Then you do your vertical one direction weaving. And you do your vertical the other direction weaving. Then you put your binder cane in.
I also wanted to ask about making holes. This was one hand tool that we haven't discussed. And the manual drill that I have down in my basement, I inherited from my grandfather who worked wood and built houses, is kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. It has, as though it comes up and then it goes, squares off to the side and then it goes up again so that you grab the handle squared off to the side and turn it round and round while you're holding the knob at the top and forcing the bottom bit into the wood. And
yep.
This action of going round and around, in fact, turns the bit, which digs a drill hole.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had something in the bottom where you could open it up, turn it this way or that way, and it loosens the grip, and then you could stick a different drill bit in there if you wanted to, fatter or smaller, and then tighten it up by turning again, and this little grip would tighten on So you just swapped out the different drill bits. And I recall from watching my father that he would usually drill a small hole, very narrow, before he would put a nail in at all, in order to make sure that the nail was true, went straight, and as a guide. And when you were working with wood, like building furniture and the like, you almost routinely use screws, right?
First of all, that's a brace and bit, what you were describing. The drill part was the brace, and then the bits that go into it. And yeah, you're right. If I use furniture, you try not to use nails. I mean, that's almost forbidden. You know, it's occasionally if you put a back on something, you can. For the most part, you try and do it with your joints and glue. Yes, the next would be if you're going to do something of that nature, then it would be with screws. One thing for people, a little trick would be if you don't want to take the time to drill, because that can be pretty tedious if you're going to be doing a whole bunch of nails, and if it's not that important that it's perfectly straight, but you want to try to prevent splitting the wood. If you just take your nail and blunt the tip of it a little bit, take your hammer and pound the tip of the nail just a little bit to flatten out the point a bit, that'll help prevent it from splitting the wood. Don't use nails too much on furniture. You can, I mean, if it's just to get it functional and up and going, I wouldn't hesitate, but for fine furniture, no, don't use it.
Yeah, the screws are so much more durable.
They're
gripping the wood, and the nail can theoretically loosen and pull out. Taking care of our manual tools once we have them, and like oiling them, removing rust, sharpening the blades with a stone, a whetstone?
Your chisels, cutting knives, all those types of things, you would be using stones, and there's different grits of stones and different styles of stones. There's oil stones, which are more of the European style. There's whetstones, which are the Asian style. My preference is the whetstones. They're very, very nice. They really sharpen tools very nicely, razor sharp. The oil stones, they're nice too if you do them right, and they tend to last longer also. But they seem to be a little harder to learn how to use.
What's the technique? Are you if it's an oil stone, you put oil on it? You run the blade at almost flat to the stone, but with a slight angle in one direction, then flip it over and run it again, you know, almost flat to the stone, but just a kind of a slight angle up, back the other way, right?
You have to learn to try and keep that angle exactly, because any rocking motion, you're changing the angle, and so you keep changing it, and it makes a huge difference in how sharp you're going to get it. On chisels, you almost always have a flat surface and your beveled surface. On carving tools, you're going to have a doubled edge, like a knife has a doubled edge, so you can cut both ways. And those generally are much harder to sharpen than, say, the chisel that has the flat edge. They're just a whole lot harder to sharpen because you've got to get that angle just right on both of them. When you're doing your honing, you don't want to put much pressure, very, very light finesse type of pressure. On the water stones, you're using water. On the oil stones, oil as a lubricant to kind of flush away the cut off pieces of metal, the detritus metal. It's kind of the technique they tell you to use, or you're taught to use, is kind of a figure eight type of rubbing, where you use both hands and you're making a figure eight.
Are you flipping it, as I said, pulling it toward you, and then flipping the knife over and pushing it away?
No, you're not flipping it over. You're keeping it, you're trying to keep that angle.
Ah.
You know, we're talking, like right now I'm talking a chisel that has a flat edge,
uh-huh,
and then the beveled edge, and you have your beveled edge down, and you're trying to keep that angle that's already on there.
Yes.
Just exactly there.
Right.
And you're using more of your body and shoulders. to do it with rather than your arms, because when you start doing your elbows and arms, you're changing the angle too easily. So you're really trying to focus your attention on keeping that angle flat on the stone.
Right.
So, keeping it going.
So you're just sharpening one side of it. With a chisel, it would be rather difficult, especially if it's a curved chisel meant to make a groove in wood.
Yeah.
You can't really sharpen the inside part. You just must sharpen the outside part.
Yeah, right. You're right.
Right.
And, but they have different gouges.
Yeah.
That do have like the inside beveled rather than the outside. But most times it's the outside that's beveled.
Right.
And that one, those kind, there are stones that are designed for that. But generally you're going to use like a hand honer where you're rubbing the stone on that rather than that on the stone, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I do, yeah. So with a knife or a flat edge, so you would keep it, and you'd sharpen on one side, and then you would flip it over and do a lot of sharpening on the other side, and not the flip back and forth technique that I was describing. Of course, I'm totally ignorant on how you sharpen a knife. I was just trying to guess.
Yeah. Well, with a knife, you know, then you would, I wouldn't know. I don't flip it while I'm doing it. I'll do one side at a time.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, they do have these very inexpensive knife sharpeners now that they have tungsten steel that's set like a V to each other at an angle, and you just pull your knife through it, and it does a pretty darn nice job, and they're very inexpensive and something that would be well worth buying and keeping in your kit.
Sure sounds like it. So are there any tools that we haven't covered? I know I was trying to rack my brain. Files are something that you like smooth down a wood surface maybe quickly. Instead of using sandpaper, you use a file, and there's different grades of file, hammer for hammer and nails. But other than that, we've kind of gone through, well, there's tools that quench together like, what am I thinking of? It looks kind of like a big C, and both ends of that C, where they're open and the air spaces between them, have little pads, and you can
C-clamps? C-clamps?
Yeah, clamp, and then there's a screw that moves these little pads closer and closer together until you're squeezing the two boards you want to glue together, and you leave it there until the glue dries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
C-clamps, you know, you're going to need clamps if you're going to glue, for sure, and also working, assembling, whether you're going to glue or not, lots of times clamps are very handy because they hold your work together as you're assembling it. You put it together and clamp it and just keep going along. And so whether you're going to screw things together or whatever, clamps are very handy. There are so many different types of, I have so many clamps in my shop, it's ridiculous. I have people come in and they just kind of goggle at my clamp collection. And I have the old style hand screws, you know, which are the two pieces of wood, and they have two Acme type of screw rods going through them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm, you picture what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Yeah, I have a number of those.
So where would somebody go? I've heard in discussions on how to get your hands on hand tools. Sometimes you can actually buy them on the Internet if you go, and there are sites that do sell. I was able to find a crosscut saw at Harbor Freight for $19.95. I was stunned that they would
sell
them. I couldn't believe that. But others, like the kind of drill that I'm describing where the handle is sticking out and you turn it round and round while you hold on to the top knob, I've never found a place that will sell those. But people have said you can go to yard sales. And often farms that I've been around forever, and maybe there's an old couple there, and they're just living on the farm, been around for 100 years or more in the family, you might find a wealth of these hand tools thrown in the barn somewhere and just, you know, left. But in your experience, where would a person find these?
Well, that's true, what you said, but what I've found now is if you're on a real tight budget or if you're trying to get a lot, Harbor Freight, for the price, it's just ridiculous. The prices that they're charging for the quality, it's not up there with the top quality, obviously, but it's good enough. So I get plenty of stuff at Harbor Freight, and Harbor Freight actually has the brazing bits.
Oh, so, it has that.
And like I saw a brace there for $10, $9.
Holy camole.
Yeah, and I just bought, I think, 6 bit for $7-$8, and normally 1 bit is that price.
Oh, wow, what a good recommendation. They're on the Internet, folks, and it's harborfreight.com, I think. Very user-friendly. So we're putting in a pitch for Harbor Freight. Thank you so much, Paul, for sharing your expertise with us this hour.
You're welcome.
This was great. And I loved where you said, because I was thinking about it just before you said it, go and look. Flip your chair over and take a look. Flip your table over. Open your drawer and look at how it's constructed. You know, if you're wondering what it should look like, there it is. So it was perfect. It was a wonderful hour.
Great.
Thanks so much.
I'm Roger, president of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-sized booklet of the gist of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet, with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.